Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon. We have an open phone line. You can call in with questions about the Bible or the Christian faith to discuss, or you can call in to discuss differences of opinion you might have with the host, problems you have with Christianity, problems you have with the Bible. Feel free to give me a call. We'll talk to you. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. For those of you who are listening in Southern California, on Thursday mornings, very early, in Temecula, we have a Bible study. I say Southern California because I don't know how far away a person might count it to be too far to come to an early morning Bible study in Temecula, but we do have at least one person who drives out every day, takes over an hour to drive in from the L.A. area. And there's others who come some distance, so it's I don't know what's reasonable from the point of view of any given person, but at 6:30 every Thursday morning, we have a Bible study in Temecula at Panera Bread, and we're going through the life and teachings of Christ, covering the four Gospels, harmony of the Gospels. That's tomorrow morning and every Thursday morning at 6:30 in Temecula at Panera Bread. Information about that can be found at our website, as can the information about this weekend. I'm speaking in the Phoenix area, mostly around Buckeye, but also in Glendale, Arizona. And we have a lot of listeners in the Phoenix area, so I just let you know, you're welcome to join us for any or all of the times I'm speaking. I'm speaking on Friday night, Saturday morning, Saturday night, Sunday morning, Sunday night. So there's quite a few different things I'm talking about, different times. And if you're interested in those meetings, you can go to thenarrowpath.com and look under the tab that says Announcements, and you'll find all you need to know about those gatherings. All right, we're going to talk first of all today to Richard from Seal Beach, California. Richard, thanks for calling. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Yeah, Steve, in Luke 21, verse 24, it says, Jerusalem will be downtrodden by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Now, of course, this happened in 70 AD, and even today, Jerusalem is still downtrodden by the Gentiles, especially the Temple Mount. So when do you think the times of the Gentiles shall be fulfilled? And I will listen to you on the radio. Thank you, Steve.
Okay, thanks for your call. Well, the term, the times of the Gentiles, which Jesus uses in Luke 21:24, is a term that's not found in any other verse of the Bible. It's just the only place that that expression is found, which means it's difficult to know exactly what it refers to, since there's no cross-reference that can give us any guidance on this. Now, some people believe it means the times that the Gentiles prevail against Israel. Some people believe it means the times that God is dealing with the Gentiles rather than with Israel. And perhaps there's even other ideas that could be applied to it. My own thought has been for some time that Jesus is saying that Jerusalem will be trodden underfoot by the Gentiles for probably the rest of history, as God deals with Gentiles. At the point where Jerusalem was destroyed, God had dealt very largely, and in some cases almost exclusively, with Israel for 1,400 or 1,500 years. And so that's a long period of history where God was dealing with Israel primarily, not with the Gentiles so much. So the end of God's dealing with Israel was when he destroyed the temple and the city and banished, you know, the remaining Jews that were not slaughtered from Jerusalem. And although, of course, there are Jewish people back in Jerusalem today, and Israel exists as a nation, it has not been restored as a godly kingdom, certainly. It is not what it was. It used to be God's chosen people in a theocracy. It's not that now. It's not even close to that. It's just another democratic nation, another democratic secular nation today. So it's not really, Israel has not been restored in any sense that resembles what Israel was in the Old Testament. And you're right. I think that the Gentiles still do tread Jerusalem underfoot. Certainly, you mentioned the Temple Mount is controlled by Muslims and not by Jews. How long will this be? The way I understand Jesus' comment is that as long as God is dealing with the Gentiles, which I believe will be until Jesus comes back, is the times of the Gentiles. And we have a similar statement, not the same expression, but one that's similarly used only once in the Bible, in Romans 11:26, that it says that partial hardness has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles have come in. Now, the fullness of the Gentiles is also another expression found only once, and it's kind of similar to the times of the Gentiles, but it's not the same thing. But I think in both cases it's saying that Israel has had, you know, its season where God dealt primarily with Israel, and for the rest of history, until Jesus comes back, I believe that God will be dealing with all the nations, not just Israel, and that would be what the Gentiles usually refers to. Jews can be, of course, part of what God's doing, and many of them are. There are many Jews who have received Christ and who are followers of His, just as there were some Gentiles who came to God in the Old Testament time. But primarily in the Old Testament time, it was Israel, the Jews, that God was mostly working with, primarily. And then ever since 70 AD, of course, He's been primarily working among the Gentiles. I don't see anything in this that suggests that that's going to be reversed. When Jesus said, until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled, that doesn't necessarily mean that after the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled, then Jerusalem won't be trodden underfoot anymore by the Gentiles. Sometimes when you see the word until, you assume that that means there's going to something will change after that. But it doesn't always mean that. For example, when God said to Jacob, I will not leave you or forsake you until I have fulfilled all that I've promised you. He's not saying I'll leave you after that. He's basically saying, in all the time that I have not yet fulfilled these promises, you can count on me being with you. He's not saying I'll cease to be with you afterwards. And the word until sometimes isn't referring to a temporary situation, but to a situation that has a goal in mind, but not necessarily one that things will change after that goal back to the old way. Some people do. Some people think that what it's saying is that when, you know, the times of the Gentiles are over, then, you know, Israel will continue as an independent nation and will not be trodden by Gentiles anymore. And that is, I suppose, one way to read it. That's not, to my mind, a necessary way to read it, and it doesn't necessarily have support from other passages of Scripture, as near as I can tell. All right, let's talk to Sherry from Detroit, Michigan. Sherry, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Steve, I have been listening to some of your lectures, and you mentioned John Nelson Darby as being sort of the person that coined the dispensational view. And Now I'm learning that there are people that think that that is a whole made-up story about him. So how do you find the truth in that particular topic as far as his credibility or the story of him?
Every church historian will agree that John Nelson Darby is the founder of what we call the dispensational system. Now, what dispensationalists sometimes say, no, he wasn't, because there were elements of it before him. Well, that's true. There were elements of it before him, but the system was formed by him in the 1830s. There was, for example, much earlier in history, the phenomenon of premillennialism. Now, Darby was premillennial, but he wasn't your classic historic premillennialist. There were premillennialist people in the earliest centuries of the church, as well as amillennialists. There's more than one view that was held in the early church, but the premillennial was very popular. But it's now Darby was premillennial, but he wasn't premillennial in the same way. His own system put his own slant on the millennium. He's the one who introduced the idea that we'll go back to the Jewish order of animal sacrifices in the temple with the Levitical priests, in the millennium. That's a dispensational position. That's not the historic premillennial. But sometimes when people hear me say, well, dispensationalism started with John Nelson Darby, they'll say, no, that's not true. There were premillennialists back in the first three centuries. Well, of course there were. That's not what I said. I didn't say there weren't premillennialists. Likewise, the pre-trib rapture became the dominant view under Darby's system. We don't know for a fact that, any group of Christians taught the pre-tribulation rapture before that. But dispensationalists will sometimes point out there were a couple of guys known to have said something that might have been pre-trib. I mean, there's this document called Pseudo-Ephraim they like to quote. It's called Pseudo-Ephraim because scholars are not sure if it's really written by Ephraim or not. I think Ephraim lived in the 4th century, if I'm not mistaken. And there's a passage from a document that's attributed to Ephraim, and scholars call it Pseudo-Ephraim, where he does talk kind of about eschatology and stuff like that, and some of the things he says sounds like he may have thought there'd be a pre-tribulation rapture. And maybe he did. I don't know if he did or not. If he did, he certainly wasn't in the mainstream of his time. I mean, at this point in time, where we live, you can find people who believe that, Satan had relations with Eve and Cain was the result. But that certainly is not a mainstream view. 1,000 years from now, someone finds a book that says that. They can't prove that that was the view of the church. There's all kinds of heretics and people who think outside the box who have said various things. When I read Pseudo-Ephraim, I wasn't even sure that I could find a pre-trib rapture in there, but I could see what they're looking at, and I could see what they're taking that way, and I thought, well, maybe he did believe in one. But if so, he disagreed with all the church fathers before and after him for a long time, which is, he could have had that opinion. There's also a Baptist minister in the late 1700s, almost into Darby's time, that apparently had a sermon where he taught something of a pre-trib rapture. Someone has found that in recent years, and if they see, this was before Darby, this one guy taught a pre-trib rapture. Well, okay, fine. I have read that, and it does appear that he did. And that was like maybe 10 years before, a few years before Darby, not a generation so much. But you do find people, individuals who taught a few of the things that Darby taught. And because of that, as soon as a dispensationalist finds, a premillennial statement or perhaps a statement that sounds like it's pre-trib rapture from someone older than Darby, they say, see, Darby didn't start this. But Darby did. Darby did start the dispensational system. He incorporated things. I mean, frankly, Darby also believed in the Trinity, as all Christians mostly do. That by finding people who believed in the Trinity before him, that doesn't mean he didn't start the dispensational system, because the Trinity is not essentially part of the dispensational system. Darby believed most of the things that most Christians believe, because he was a Christian. But he did introduce new ideas about Israel and about end times, and his view of the pre-trib rapture was not mainstream, as far as we know, in any group of Christians prior to him. And his view of the millennium, although he was certainly not the first person to ever be premillennial, as far as we know, he was the first person to introduce elements of the millennium that made it a restoration of the Jewish order of the temple and sacrifices. So, I mean, you need to understand what's being said and what's not being said. When someone says dispensationalism was created by John Nelson Darby, every church historian will say the same thing about that. But when dispensationalists want to argue that their views are much older than Darby's, then they point to people who held one thing or another that sounds similar in some respect to what Darby said at a time earlier than Darby. And certainly there are people who said some things that sound similar, but his system is his. He made up the system. And he himself said so. Darby said that what he was presenting is not found in any commentaries or church fathers. He said that he had had this, basically he'd sorted this out originally with himself. He said it was a rediscovered truth that was lost after the time of the apostles. So Darby wasn't shy about saying that he was the first person to teach, apart from the apostles themselves, he thought, the first person to teach the things that he taught. Though, of course, like anyone who teaches novel things, even Joseph Smith and Charles Taze Russell and people like that, you know, people who started Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons, right. they have some things they teach that Christians have always taught, like there's a God, like Jesus is the Son of God. I mean, those are things that Christians believe, and so do they. But and you'll even find that the heretical teachings of the Jehovah's Witnesses about Jesus, about him not being God, those are found in some ancient writers in the church, Arius, for example, but was not ever the mainstream of the church. Actually, the truth is, the Arian view, which is what Jehovah's Witness believe heretically about Jesus, was actually a widespread view in many churches in the early days of the church, and therefore it has more of a pedigree of being part of the ancient church than Darbyism does. But anyway, you know, the real issue about Darbyism, it's not so much did he originate it or not. I mean, it's not impossible to imagine that he might have been the first person to see what's really true. I don't think so. But, you know, the rightness or wrongness of dispensationalism does not rest upon who taught it when, but on whether it's in the Bible or not. And, of course, in my opinion,
I agree with
not.
That 100%. That's exactly what I said when I was having a conversation with my mother, who's not even in this whole thing. But I said, it doesn't matter at the end of the day. It's how do you interpret the Bible. It doesn't have anything to do with what his view was. But
yeah,
she got in on a conversation I'm having with someone else, so it's all good. I appreciate your input.
Okay, Sherry, I appreciate your call. God bless you today. Let's talk to Nay from Connecticut. Hi, Nay. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. God bless. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
So I have two quick questions. The first one comes from Matthew 24:24. I'm confused by the reference made that says that believers, if possible, can be deceived by this false prophet in Christ. And I'd like your take on that, whether it means that we may get deceived or we should not get deceived. And then my second question comes from 1 Peter 2:9, where he says, you know, you're a royal priesthood, holy nation, yada, yada. Is he addressing the Jews or is he addressing Gentiles?
All
and
right.
I'll take your answer off the air.
Okay, thanks for your call. On the matter of Matthew 24:24, where Jesus said, for false Christs and false prophets will arise and show great signs and wonders so as to deceive, if possible, even the elect. Some people have said, see, this is saying that the elect can't be deceived because he said they could only deceive them if possible. But it's not saying that elect people can't be deceived. It's saying that even elect people could be if they can be possibly. See, a person cannot possibly be deceived while they're holding on to the truth and while they know the truth. You could bring in the best apologist for Hinduism into my room and give me the best shot they can give to prove that Hinduism is true, and they're not going to deceive me because I know the Bible, I know the facts, you know, that lie behind the Bible, I know Christ, and therefore I won't be deceived. Now, there might be some true Christians who are among what we call the elect, because the whole church is called the elect. There might be some in the church who would be deceived because they are not well-grounded in the truth. If possible, these people just will lead astray even elect people. Now, it doesn't say it's not possible. I think for some of the elect, it's possible, and for some, it's not. I think that's what it's suggesting. Although, of course, it is a bit ambiguous, but that's how I would take it. In 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9, Peter says to his readers, you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, who once were not a people, but are now the people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. Now, you ask if these are Jews or Gentiles. This is the church he's writing to. He makes it very clear in the opening verse that he's writing to Christians. Now, some people say he's writing to Jewish Christians. Well, I don't see how that would be, because he says in verse 10 to them, you once were not a people, but you're now the people of God. Now, the Jews were the people of God in the Old Testament times. but the Gentiles were not. And therefore, when he says, you are now a chosen generation who were not previously one. Well, the Jews previously were one. Actually, in the Old Testament at Mount Sinai, God told them that he was making a covenant with them that would make them into his own precious, special people and a holy nation, a kingdom of priests. All those things that Peter says his readers are. But he says in verse 10 that his readers were not that before. So certainly the church is not made up of only Jews. And he's writing to churches. There are Jews and Gentiles in the church. He's saying the church made up of Jews and Gentiles, not just Jewish people, but it's the church that's the chosen generation, the royal priesthood, the holy nation, his own special people. In other words, the church is now, because of its loyalty to Christ and to the covenant that he has made, the true Israel, just as the people that Moses led out of Egypt were the Israel when they were loyal to his covenant in the Old Testament. There's a new covenant now, so being loyal to the old covenant doesn't do any good, because where there's a new covenant, the old is obsolete, the writer of Hebrews says. So there's certainly no good reason to believe these are Jewish people. It's a very common thing for some dispensationalists to say that the books of Peter were written to Jewish believers. But he certainly didn't give that impression. He said he's writing to, you know, those who were chosen, you know, who were pilgrims of the dispersion from Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. These are largely Gentile areas. And it'd be a strange thing for him to write a letter simply to the Jewish Christians in the Gentile churches. That would be certainly undoing what Paul had done. Paul had actually evangelized those areas and did all he could to avoid allowing there to be divisions between the Jews and the Gentiles, especially in Galatia, which is one of these places. Paul wrote a letter to the Galatians trying to make sure that they did not think there was any difference between Jewish or Gentile in Christ. And so if Peter was now trying to build up that middle wall of partition that was broken down by Christ, according to Paul, and say, no, I've got some things to say that just apply to the Jewish Christians. They're a chosen people. They're a special people. They're the holy nation. Well, then he would certainly be building up a wall sinfully, a wall of division in the body of Christ, when in fact we have no evidence that Peter was doing such a thing. He also says that his readers had formerly been engaged in idolatry. He says that in chapter 4. He says, in verse 3, we've spent enough of our past lifetime doing the will of the Gentiles when we walked in licentiousness, lust, drunkenness, revelries, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. Now, the Jews actually didn't practice idolatry after the Babylonian exile, so his readers, who were Jewish, were not converted out of idolatrous background, but out of Jewish background. But the Gentiles were converted out of idolatrous background. So Peter makes it very clear that his readers are made up of, well, of course, like any church, made up of Jews and Gentiles, but they were predominantly Gentile people who were saved out of idolatry and who were not previously a people, as the Jews were. So you could never say to a Jewish Christian in the first century that before you became a Christian, you were not a people, because they were. The Jews were the people of God. But he says his readers at this point were not previously the people of God and are now. So there's really certainly no case of that can be credibly made that Peter has Jewish readers rather than just Christians in general in mind. Let's see. We're going to take another call, but we have a break coming up. So if we have to interrupt, we'll hold you over the break if necessary. Hi, Ann from Dallas, Texas. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call, and blessings and salutations. I'll ask the question, and then I'll hang up and listen for your answer. I have a wonderful pastor, and I love him to death, and he's been a pastor for almost 21 years. But unfortunately, bless his heart, he does not teach at all on the end of time. The only thing that he tells us is that, don't worry, God takes his children out. As long as you love one another as Christ loves the church, and you spread the gospel, and you repent and try to be Christ-like, you don't have to worry. So don't worry about the end of times. Well, that's fine, but that's all well and good, but it doesn't really help me or my 9 grandchildren, that I feel like I need to instruct my grandchildren to be wise as serpents. So can you just direct me to teach my family books? Where can I go to start learning, because I'm way behind. Someone told me last week in church that 6 or 5 of the trumpets have already been blown. Well, that scared me to death. It scared me to death. So I do apologize. I'm very ignorant, and I apologize for that. So I'm going outside of my pastor to learn. So thank you, and God bless.
Okay. Yeah, God bless you, and I'll be glad to address that. What I think I'll do, though, because we do have a break coming up really quickly, and I don't want to just say something for a few seconds and then take a break, I'll hold it until the break is done, and that's going to be just about a minute from now. We'll be able to address that. So we'll keep that on the front burner for the beginning of the next half hour. We have a break at the bottom of each hour in order to let our listeners know that the Narrow Path is listener-supported. If you've been listening since the beginning of the program, you notice there were no commercial breaks, and there will be none before the program's over either. We have no sponsors, no commercial breaks. We don't sell anything. We don't have any money-making apparatus of any kind, but we do pay a lot of money to be on the radio, and we just let our listeners know at the bottom of the hour, as I am right now, that we are supported by listeners, and we're not done with the show. Don't let the music chase you off. We have another half hour ahead. But we do pay a lot of money that comes that's owed to radio stations. And we don't have any payroll. We don't have any overhead. Just paying for time on the radio. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, it's possible to do so. You can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. That's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can go to our website. Now, our website's loaded with resources. Nothing costs a thing there. We got thousands of resources. That's no hyperbole. And you can get them for free from thenarrowpath.com, where it's also possible to donate, but you don't need to, at thenarrowpath.com. I'll be right back.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. Welcome to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you today, but everything to give you. When the radio show is over, go to thenarrowpath.com where you can study, learn, and enjoy with free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. See you at thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We have another half hour of taking your phone calls. If you'd like to be on the program, you have a question about the Bible you'd like to discuss, you have a difference of opinion from the host you'd like to discuss, feel free to give me a call. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. 37. And I want to remind our Phoenix area listeners, I'm speaking in Phoenix this weekend several times, all through the weekend. You can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and look there for the time and place under the tab that says announcements. All right. Now, just before the break, we had a call from Ann in Dallas, Texas, who was saying that she was concerned because her pastor doesn't talk about the end times. And he just basically says, don't worry about it, just serve the Lord and don't worry about it. I have to tell you, I agree with your pastor. But the fact is that you heard some people tell you that, you know, the first 5 trumpets have sounded or something like that in Revelation, and implying that, you know, the end is very near, you know, Antichrist is coming, Jesus is coming. And you're concerned that you need to be informed so that you can warn your children and grandchildren. I can understand that desire. Just let me give you some perspective on this. There are a certain kind of people, and you've talked to some of them apparently, who think it's very important for us to know how near the end is. I'm not sure why they think that's important. I guess they figure that some people who would not love God ordinarily might pretend to love God if they knew the end was near, because after all, they don't want God to catch them unloving to him. Of course, if they love God, they don't. A person who loves God doesn't care if the end's near or far. We'd love for Jesus to come back soon. We long to see him. But it's not going to make a difference in our life if he waits, because we love God. We're going to live for God. But there are people who don't love God, or at least they think that others will not love God enough to serve him unless they can scare them into believing that, you know, the tribulation is upon us, the Antichrist is upon us, and so forth. Let me just say that if it is true that we are near the end of the age and that Jesus is coming back in the next few years, and maybe that we'll see Antichrist rise and so forth, if that is true, I don't know a thing you can do differently to make it happen differently. I mean, if that's what God's doing, that's what God's doing. The one thing important to all is that we serve the Lord. And I agree with your pastor. If you serve the Lord, then you don't have to worry about knowing the details, because nobody does know the details. Your friend who said that some of the trumpets have sounded and so forth, she or he is influenced by a certain view of the book of Revelation, which I don't share, and which many people do not. And it's not necessary to believe it, what they believe. There's different views of Revelation, and some of them are, to my mind, more reliable and more truthful than the one that you heard from your friend. But I do have a book. You're welcome to, you asked for a resource. I have a book called Revelation Four Views, a parallel commentary, which I wrote, and it's available anywhere that books are sold. You can go on Amazon or christianbook.com and put my name in there, Steve Gregg, and that book and my book on the three views of hell will both come up. It's Revelation Four Views is what it's called, and that would be the resource I think it would help you to read. But the main thing is that Jesus' disciples, before he ascended, asked him, "Are you at this time going to restore the kingdom to Israel?" He said, "It's not for you to know the times or the seasons." Now, times and seasons refers to general time frames of the things that the Father has said in his own power. Jesus basically told him not to worry about that. And that's what your pastor is saying, too. Don't worry about it. Now, you're going to hear a lot of people who are all excited about it, but let me put it in perspective. I think you said you're kind of a new Christian, or at least you said you were ignorant. Everybody's ignorant about many things, but I have to say that I've been in the ministry for 50 years, and when I first was in the ministry in 1970, there was a big rage over the immediate coming of Christ. Hal Lindsey had written a book that sold 20 million copies called The Late Great Planet Earth. It sold more than that later. It immediately sold 20 million copies. It was a huge bestseller. And it was saying basically that Jesus is coming back before the early 80s. And many churches were really caught up in this, like your friend apparently is. And they were sure Jesus got to come back before 1981 and rapture the church. Well, that didn't happen. And so they began to revise their dates and so forth. Another guy put out a book that went out to every pastor in America, I think. He sent them out free copies, called 88 Reasons Why the Rapture Will Occur in 1988. He was off on that, too. Then there's some Korean group of Christians that had their own ideas about the second coming was going to come in the early 90s. I forget what year, 92 or so. That didn't work out either. Then there was Harold Camping, and he put out two different books with two different years, because the first one failed to come true. He put out another one with another year, and both failed to come true. And every time somebody says, we're really near the end, and Jesus is coming or in such and such a year, all these predictions have one thing in common. They're all false, and they've all been proven false. And your friend's predictions will probably be proven false also, because Jesus has not given us information. God has not given us information to know how near the end we are. Now, if someone says, well, we need to know we're near the end, I think, first of all, why? Why do I need to know if I'm near the end or not? Am I going to serve Jesus differently or less if we're not near the end? Why would I do that? Am I only serving Jesus for convenience? Because, well, it'd be very inconvenient for him to catch me not serving him, so I better do it. If that's true, if I'm serving Jesus for convenience, there's a good reason to do it every single day, because I could die today. And there will be several million, hundreds of million people who will die today. I don't know whether I'll be among them or not, but I'll be one on one of these days. And I'm living in my last generation. I don't know if I'm in the last generation, but I'm living in my last generation. So I could die today, and if not today, it won't be very much longer. So I should live for Christ if I'm mainly concerned about, you know, being ready when Jesus comes. Well, that's equally important that I be ready when I die, because that's, in a sense, him coming for me at that day. So it doesn't really make any difference if Jesus is coming back in the next year or 10 years or 100 years. I'll be dead before then. I'll be dead before 100 years from now. So I fully expect to be dead in less than 30 years, maybe considerably less. That being so, I don't really see that knowing how soon Jesus is going to come back would make a difference at all, just like I don't know when I'm going to die. Both things would have the same ramifications. If Jesus comes back or if I die, both of them mean I stand before God. Now, some people might think, well, there's another thing. If Jesus comes back soon, then we're going to have to be ready to face Antichrist or else tribulation. Well, that's true whether Jesus comes back soon or not, too. Jesus told us we're going to have tribulation. Paul told us we'll have tribulation. Christians need to be ready for tribulation, whether it's the tribulation or some other tribulation. It doesn't really matter. There's Christians in China. There's Christians in North Korea for whom the tribulation couldn't be any worse than it is right now. There's nothing worse could be done to them than what they've been through. And that's been true of Christians in the Roman Empire under Nero. That's been true of under communist countries and of some in Muslim countries throughout church history. I think that we need to get our perspective right. We sometimes feel like the norm is for Christians to live like us Americans are living right now, comfortable, not persecuted, prosperous, happy, well-fed, and secure. And you know, if we're living at a time when that's going away, we really want to be prepared for that. Well, prepare for that. Because whether Jesus is coming back this century or in another century off in the future, we still are facing, no doubt, future tribulation. Not maybe the tribulation that Jesus spoke about, but who cares? Who cares whether it's that one or another one? What's the worst thing the Antichrist can do to Christians during the tribulation? Cut their heads off? Well, Christians are getting their heads cut off now and have for the past 2,000 years. So, I mean, what's the difference? I don't really think that this fascination with the end times is a healthy one. I do think that Christians do need to have, as part of their theological mindset, that Jesus will someday come back and set everything right. And Christians have always had that in their theological mindset. And that's been for 2,000 years. And if it's another 2,000 years before Jesus comes back, we still have to, all Christians have to have it in their mindset, someday Jesus will fix things. Because you have to know that history makes sense. History doesn't make sense at all if things aren't ever going to get fixed. But they don't have to get fixed now in order for history to make sense. There's ups and downs. There's horrible times and good times. And someday God is going to fix everything. In the meantime, we have our life to live for God, and it will have its end. And so will your children and your grandchildren. I think that teaching people to live for God rather than to look for an immediate coming of Christ is much wiser. Because you know what? Again, I knew people who got saved as teenagers in 1970 because they were told Jesus was coming back right away. Guess what? He didn't. And some of those people just decided, well, what the heck? I guess this Christianity thing's for the birds. Because what all the preachers were saying was simply a lie. Jesus wasn't, in fact, coming right away. And much better to say things that you know are true, because then you'll never be found to be a liar. If you say Jesus is coming soon, well, you might be right, or you might not be right. Nobody really knows. You asked me for a resource. My own book on Revelation, I think, is a resource I'd recommend, Revelation 4 Views. It'll help put some perspective on this matter for you because, I mean, a lot of people are assuming that Revelation is describing the times we're living in now. And there's, honestly, I don't think there's any good reason to believe that's true. But I also have lectures on the subject, and you can also go to other resources on our website that talk about, you know, end times or the passages in the Bible that are about end times. We've got lectures on every verse of the Bible in our website. They're all free. So those are my thoughts. I mean, the main thing was you were concerned your pastor was neglecting this subject. I think your pastor's, I mean, I don't know if I agree with your pastor about his theology, but I think he was probably well justified in saying, you know, I'm not going to be teaching about the end times. I don't even know if any of us are going to live to see the end times. But I do know that we're going to live to see temptation tomorrow, temptation to compromise, temptation to be unforgiving, temptation to be unloving, temptation to do the wrong thing. And that's what I need to be teaching my congregation, is how to live for Jesus. Because you know what? If you're living for Jesus, then he can come at any time, it's no problem. Or you can die at any time, it's no problem. The main thing is to be living for Jesus all the time. And if there are people who would pretend to love God because they think the rapture's coming or something and the tribulation's coming soon, I don't think God's going to be fooled. I don't think God's ever fooled by people who pretend. And anyone who really loves God will love him for who he is, not because they're trying to save their skin from an imminent danger. If a person wants to just convert so they don't go into the tribulation, they're not thinking about anyone but themselves, and that's not how you get saved. That's how you just look out for yourself, which is the opposite of getting saved. It's when you surrender yourself, when you deny yourself, take up your cross, and you'll do anything for Jesus Christ, including die, if it calls for that. That's when you really are in a position to really know Jesus, because he doesn't really make himself known to people who are just playing games with him and trying to, you know, get fire insurance. That's not what he's about. He's not an insurance salesman. He's a Lord. And so what he wants people to do is to recognize him as Lord and embrace him out of love for his lordship. And anyone who does that doesn't have to worry a thing about the end times. Because, as I say, today may be the end time for you. It might be your last day. I hope it isn't for you, but it is for some people. And so, obviously, it would have been good for them to have gotten right with God and to live for him. Because, I don't know, I'm just taking the same position your pastor is, so you might be unhappy with me about that. Eddie from Connecticut, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. Steve, the Jewish custom for preparing a body for, you know, for burial was to anoint the body and then with the spices and the myrrh. And my question is, they did that for the benefit of the people with the, you know, the funeral procession and the burial, because the body, when it died, it gave off a stench pretty quick. So that was for the benefit of the people at the funeral or burial. So my question is, we read in the resurrection story, Mary and her friends went 3 days later with the spices to the tomb. And you're saying, wait a minute, he's already buried. Why would someone go 3 days later to do that? Who are you trying to... The body's already buried, is my question.
Yeah.
So why would you do that? It's almost like I'm going to go and bomb somebody after they're buried.
Yeah.
Why? What? And then you read in John 19, it says Nicodemus already brought the spices to do that when they wrapped him in linen. So you see, and Mary didn't know that. So it was like, wait a minute, his body was already prepared, but yet you're going 3 days later to the tomb to do it again. So it was just a Bible study we were having, and we were saying, wait a minute, it's not making sense here. Why would you go the spices when you put that on the body, the spices and the ointments and everything was for the living. So we're not saying, how are we going to go to this funeral here? We can't even breathe. It stinks. So why would you do it in a sealed tomb? Who are you trying not to offend with the smell? It's already over with. She didn't know the body was going to be raised up. She was going to... So when you read about that, we're just curious about why someone would bring the spices 3 days later.
Sure.
When it was already done.
Well, it says in Mark 16:1, now when the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene, Mary, mother of James, and Salome brought spices that they might come and anoint him. It doesn't say that they're planning to do a full embalming of the body or anything like that. And I honestly don't know that we're correct in saying that the whole purpose of anointing the body after its death was to strictly to, you know, counteract the smell of a rotting body. In most cases, a body was buried the same day that it died because of its rapid decomposition. And therefore, sometimes it hadn't really begun to stink yet. Remember when Jesus was asked them to roll the stone away from the tomb of Lazarus, Martha said, well, he's been dead for 4 days. By now he stinks. You know, the assumption is that he didn't stink when they buried him, but he would by now. So I don't really know if the embalming was strictly or even primarily for the sake of the people at the funeral. Even if the body stank, they could stand far enough away. But I think the issue here was that it was their idea of how they showed honor to the dead. And it, you know, to anoint with spices. We see that Mary, the sister of Martha, did that to Jesus while he was alive.
Right.
And clearly it was to honor him, because his body was not stinking at that point. Well, it might have been. I mean, everybody's body stank probably back then. They probably bathed about once a month, but if that. But the truth is, it wasn't decomposing. She poured this valuable perfume over him just as a way of showing lavish affection and honor to him, which we would not do. I wouldn't like someone pouring oil or perfume over my head. I was raised during the time where we all want the dry look on our hair. You know, we don't want grease all over our hair. So, I mean, that's a cultural thing. That's not the way I want anyone to honor me, thanks. But back then, I think it was a way of honoring him. Remember when Jesus came to eat dinner at the home of Simon the Pharisee, and the woman anointed Jesus' feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair? He rebuked the Pharisees. When I came to you, you didn't anoint my head with oil when I came in here. And you didn't wash my feet. These are just different ways that you would honor a guest. So I think probably by anointing the dead body, it was probably also just a way of showing honor, not so much a way of embalming. Now, it's true that Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea had done something to embalm the body. But I don't think the women were seeking to do the same thing he did. I think they just wanted to show their respects, because Jesus had hastily been buried, because they wanted to get the body buried before sundown on the Sabbath. It was almost sundown. So they came as soon as Sabbath was over to pay their respects. And I think the coming to you know, anoint the body with spices or whatever was just a Middle Eastern way of showing respect. Unless I'm mistaken about this, but that's how I think about it.
And Steve, wouldn't it be when Mary and Martha were going that morning to the tomb? I mean, they must have knew that there was a stone in front of it. How were they going to go about moving that stone?
Well, they were actually discussing that very thing. You find as they were on their way, they in verse 3 of Mark 16 says they said among themselves, "Who will roll the stone from the door of the tomb for us?" They obviously hadn't figured out all the logistics yet. Which shows us they were acting out of sheer, devotion, not necessarily entirely rationally. They weren't sure how they're going to work this out. All they knew is that the sun was up, the Sabbath was over. This is the first opportunity they had to visit the tomb, hopefully to get inside. They didn't even know how they're going to get the stone moved. Fortunately, an angel had worked that out, but they didn't know that would be the case. Maybe the guards would move it for him, or maybe, who knows. I don't think they had it figured out. I think they were going mostly on emotion and not entirely on, you know, rational planning.
Correct. All right, Steve, thank you so much for your answer.
All right. God bless you, Eddie. Good talking to you. All right. Pat from Fort Worth, Texas, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I just wondered about churches that anymore don't seem to believe in throwing out demons, and people go through life with demons, and I'm sure their heart's good, but then they go to heaven, and I just wonder, how do we know there's not a punishment for what we do on earth and heaven? Heaven, that we actually get punished?
That we Christians who go to heaven would not be punished? How do we know that?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, there's several parts to your question. One was about demons. There are certain churches that probably believe in demon possession and probably believe in exorcism, but they don't feel that they encounter it very often. Even if they do, they may not recognize it, because we live in a time where if you see a demon-possessed person who's acting up, you might just assume they're mentally ill and give them some meds. And they seem to calm down. You know, a lot of people are very reluctant to recognize demon possession as such, because it's spooky to them and it's unfamiliar, and they'd rather find some other way to explain the problem. Even if they do believe that exorcism is a real thing, they probably very seldom encounter cases that they're willing to acknowledge to need it. Other cases, there are Pentecostal and charismatic groups that are quite willing to cast demons out of people. And sometimes are very helpful in that respect, although sometimes they might see demons under every bush. Sometimes they're a little too much eager to find demons where it may not even be that issue. Then there's, of course, cessationist people who don't even believe that demon possession is a reality anymore. So there's all kinds of different groups. Now, as far as how do we know we won't be punished in heaven? Well, because the people who will end up in heaven are the people who have been justified by Christ. And justified means that our sins are covered, or that we're declared just, we're righteous. Now, of course, all of us have actually committed real sins, and some people more than others, but all sins, I believe, are dealt with when we're justified by Christ. So there'd be nothing left to be punished for. Now, I will say that among those who are justified, there are those who've done more for God in their lifetime, and there will be, apparently, from the parables Jesus told about the pounds and about the talents and so forth, there apparently will be different rewards for those who are saved that not everyone will have. But those who don't have them are not being punished. They certainly haven't warranted the special rewards that others will have. So, I don't know. I mean, if you're wondering whether after we're justified by Christ, there's still some sins that aren't quite covered and we'll have to be punished for in heaven, that's kind of the view the Catholics have, only they don't let you go to heaven until you get punished for those.
Yeah.
You have to go to purgatory, and then when you're done there...
But there's nothing in the Bible about purgatory either, is there?
No, not a word. Not a word, uh-uh.
Right.
All right.
I just wondered because, a lot of people refuse to acknowledge there could be anything wrong with them. And I've always heard that you can't really cast a demon out of a person if he wants to keep it because he likes it.
I suspect that may be true. I mean, people do have free will.
You can't cast
Jesus into somebody if they don't want Jesus in them. So I'm not sure you can cast a demon. I think people have the stewardship over their own lives under God, and they have to want help, I think, before we can
maybe
give them much help.
We don't
That's
think of it right, but I've heard, you know this, that there are over 300 promises in the Bible, but there are 200 commands, like do not fail to communicate. Do not fail.
Yeah, I've actually never counted up the promises or the commands.
Well, I know. I'm just saying that if there's that many commands, not just 10,
the Jewish law has 613 commands, according to the rabbis, and that could be the right number. And there's more commands in the New Testament, too. Anyway, I appreciate your call. We're almost out of time, and I don't know if Kelvin from Garland, Texas, will have enough time for what you want to say, but go ahead. You've got the last minute, at least.
Yes. Hi, this is Kelvin, Steve. Real quickly,
yes.
I was just listening to your comment about the pastor ignoring end-time prophecy and stuff.
Uh-huh.
Is that, I'm of the belief that there is going to come a generation, a people, at some point in church, the church experience, where it will be the end times.
Sure.
It will be the time of the return of the Lord, and there are many prophecies in the Bible dealing with that it will be appropriate to extensively study for that part of the church at that time.
Yeah, see, I don't believe there's that many. I don't think there's very many prophecies about the end times. I believe a lot of the prophecies that people think are about the end times have actually been fulfilled in times long ago. But I do believe you're right. There will be a generation that is the generation that will see Jesus come back. But I can't think of a thing that they would need to know that we don't need to know. I mean, the mission of the church is the same in every generation. And Jesus said, blessed is that servant if when his master comes, finds him so doing. We're all supposed to be doing what Jesus told us to do, and the servant that is doing it when his master shows up will be blessed. Jesus said, your master will come at a time when you think not. So if Jesus said he's going to come back when we don't think he's going to, then it suggests that the generation of Christians that are living at the time he comes back will not be thinking he's going to be necessarily coming back. We don't have any real clear information on what generation that will be. So I think to concern ourselves with things that can't help us and don't change anything about our duty would be a waste of time when there's so many things we should be focused on that are part of our duty. You're listening to The Narrow Path. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you.
Steve Gregg answers your Bible questions every weekday from 2 to 3, live here on True Talk 800, and that was sponsored by The Narrow Path. Coming up in just a moment, some Bible teaching from Pastor Ron Mell in Heart of the Word. And then at 3:30, it's Pathway to Victory with Dr. Robert Jeffress. Are you in need of prayer? Would you value having a chance to pray for others? Well, True Talk 800 has partnered with Adventist Health to provide a 24/7 prayer network called PrayerWorks. It's an online community where you can post your prayer requests and share a bit of your story. You can also read other people's stories and prayer requests and let them know you're praying for them as well. Visit kpdq.com and enter the keyword prayer to join our prayer network today. That's PrayerWorks at kpdq.com. Just enter the keyword prayer.
Okay, from the start.
Alfalfa cherry.
Alfalfa leaf, aloe vera, apples, asparagus, banana.
Beets, bell pepper, broccoli.
Blueberries, blackberries, cranberry.
We make Texas superfood from 55 raw, vine-ripened fruits and vegetables. And then we add nothing.
Pineapple, sweet potato,
papaya, parsley.
In a capsule or a powder, one daily dose of Texas superfood delivers the healthy benefits of 55. Count them. 55 fresh fruits and vegetables, and you can see them all on TexasSuperfood.com.
Raspberry, spinach, the nutrients that we need on a daily basis.
Thousands of people benefit from taking Texas Superfood every day. Shouldn't you be one of them? Doctors, pharmacists, nurses, and your grandmother all recommend that you eat more fruits and vegetables every day. So if you can't, won't, or don't, Texas Superfood is made for you.
It's borderline shocking how much energy I have.
Join us on TexasSuperfood.com.
Texas Superfood.
TexasSuperfood.com.
KPDQ Portland, a service of Salem Media Group. Listen online at TrueTalk800.com.
It's just after 3 o'clock and time for Heart of the Word with Pastor Ron Mell on True Talk 800.
I need your guiding hand every single day. Lord, humbly I come and say, Lord, show me where to walk. Show me the things to do today. And verse 13 is to pray triumphantly and to say, Lord, would you deliver us? For yours is the kingdom, the power, and the glory. Maybe your earthly father is not the greatest example of a father, but I'm extremely thankful here that this father is very concerned about you and me. And it's one of the reasons why I don't have to be selfish in my prayers anymore. Because he watches you and me every day, all the day long. He knows what I have need of. And because he knows what I have need of, he's already set himself to provide the thing that I need, to supply what it is that I need. And while the Lord is faithful to do that, I think that's why Jesus said, would you pray, our Father which art in heaven? He's so faithful and he's so good. And you discover over and over again here that it's us. Give us thy kingdom come. In the midst of everything that is asked, Lord, it is for you and it is for me. But secondly, is to pray earnestly. And I want you just to turn over a few pages to the right to the book of Luke, would you? It's really parallel in that in the book of Luke, chapter 11, you will read about the Lord's prayer. But I want you to notice something else, and it's in Luke chapter 11, verses 5 through 10. And when I say praying earnestly, let me tell you what I mean. In Luke chapter 11, verses 5 to 10, there was a man who had company, and his company came unexpectedly, and he needed 3 loaves of bread. And he didn't have 3 loaves of bread, and obviously, apparently, the store was closed, and he couldn't get bread anyplace, and so he went to his neighbor's house, and he knocked on the door. And obviously, as you look at this text, you discover that it's late at night. It's so late that the man is already in bed with his children. And the man knocks and he asks for 3 loaves of bread. And the man says, go away. I'm already in bed with my children. Go away. I don't want to be bothered. And the Bible says that the man continued to knock. And eventually what happened? The man inside got up from his bed, from his children, and he went and he got the bread and he gave it to the man. And the reason that he brought the bread to the man was that the man came with such boldness. He was unashamed at all to come and to knock that late at night. And he was really persistent. And I noticed two things. When I say pray earnestly, here's what I mean. I want to try and explain this as best I can. Number one, I noticed, and this is really important, I noticed the unbelievable desire that this man has. And he knocks, and he's taken no for an answer. Say, well, when you need bread, you'll knock all night long too, because if you don't have food to eat, you need food, and you'll knock all night long. He knocked as long as it took. He knocked and he knocked and he knocked. So it's really important. His persistence really, really, it seems pretty obvious when you read this. But the second thing is, it isn't just that he has a great passion and desire and he's persistent. I also notice this, and that is that he's doing this for somebody other than himself. That's really important. Because I'm going to tell you this. When it comes to prayer, I know I would knock on somebody's door all night long if my wife and our family needed bread. I'd knock all night long. Wouldn't you? Sure you would. If you were starving, you didn't have anything, you didn't have any food, and you had food, wouldn't you knock? Sure you would. But that's no way this man is knocking. This man isn't knocking because he's hungry. This man is knocking because friends have come and there is no food for them. It's one thing to say, I would with great passion pray all night long because I'm concerned about my children.